is a production of Cornell University.
Well, good afternoon. It's 4:31 on April 8th, and I'm calling this meeting in the University Assembly to order. First item on the agenda is welcome and some introductions. We have a lot of visitors today, so first I'd like to welcome to the Assembly Miss Emily Sanchirico, did I get it right? President Scorton's appointee to be the Judicial Codes Counselor in FY15 for our approval in a few moments. We also have with us Mr. Dan Roth, the Director of the Campus Sustainability Office, at the podium. Professor David Shalloway, a professor of molecular biology and genetics, who is going to speak to us about divestment. Jeffrey Bergfault, a graduate student in mathematics, who's also going to talk about divestment. We have Mr. A.J. Edwards, the Chief Investment Officer of Cornell. And we have Ms. Joanne DiStefano, the Vice President for Finance and CFO for Cornell. And I think, as we all know, the main topic of today will be carbon neutrality and divestment, which we'll get into thick in just a few moments. But first, we have the meeting minutes from March 25th. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Motion by Ms. Schaffner, seconded by Mr. Moore. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions? The minutes are approved. Coming to business of the day, first up is approval of the appointment of Emily Sanchirico, to serve as the Judicial Codes Counselor. The floor recognizes Professor Wayne.
So it's my pleasure to present Emily Sanchirico today. The University Assembly has a position on the Judicial Codes Counselor selection. And it's a group of people that includes Anne Lucadale, who was the chair of the Swimming Center this year for the Times for the movement. Kevin Claremont of the Law School, David DeVries, Associate Dean in the Art School, Dear Beth Grant, who you all know. The current and future Judicial Codes Counselor, Andrew Watts and Amanda Minicus, and Nora Salvatore of the council process. And we get a chance to look at the top contenders that the current and future Judicial Codes Administrator has selected. They selected about 23 candidates. They selected candidates that had terrific interpersonal skills and good communication skills. But it seemed like a secondary characteristic. After the criminal defense work was just as important. So all the candidates were terrific that we interviewed. We interviewed the top three. Emily was unanimously selected by all of us because she had, as I said, terrific communication skills and a passion for criminal defense. You'll all be happy to hear when I ask her about the campus code. She pulled out her copy. And a lot. They're thinking about a lot of things. The president has approved her, and now it's up to us to approve the president.
So our role is one of confirmation. Are there questions for Professor Wayne about the process or the nominee? If none, then there is a moved motion to approve Emily Sanchirico as the Judicial Codes Counselor for FY15. Is there a second?
Second.
From Professor Lowe, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Abstentions?
Do I have to?
No, you do not have to.
Aye.
One abstention, the chair, as is usual. The motion passes. Congratulations. And welcome. Now we move on to carbon neutrality. As everyone here is aware, the Faculty Senate passed a resolution on sustainability. They forwarded it to us, asking for us to join them in support of their resolution. That was Faculty Senate Resolution 10-13. Copies have been sent to you, and there are copies at the end of the table if you need one for your reference. The assembly at a previous meeting decided to tee up that subject, and we invited experts on all facets of these issues to join us today and make sure that members have the information they need before deciding whether to vote in favor of the Faculty Senate resolution or to do something different. First up is the importance of carbon neutrality and the Climate Action Plan by Mr. Dan Roth. The chair recognizes Mr. Roth for 15 minutes. And welcome.
Thank you very much, sir. So I was asked to speak about a bit of Cornell's history and why, Cornell's history with climate neutrality, that's not in general, I would take much more than 15 minutes, and talk about some of the science that has been guiding the university's decisions on taking action on our carbon emissions for the last 10 years or so. This is the cover of the university's newest climate action plan update. I actually have copies of what the Board of Trustees approved just over a week ago now, the executive summary. This is actually going to be going public in just a few weeks in terms of putting things up on our website. But the Board of Trustees approved our goal of achieving carbon neutrality or climate neutrality. That is building on a commitment that was made by President Scorton beginning in 2008. In 2007, he signed a national commitment through an organization called the ACU-EPC, American College and University President's Climate Commitment. And in 2009, we released our first climate action plan that proposed a strategic direction to achieve zero carbon emissions as a campus. And we've been updating that plan since, every 2 years, and we do a greenhouse gas inventory every other year to make sure that we're keeping progress on our goals. So I'm going to review some of what happened kind of leading up to that and some of the science of why the university and the president and many of the constituents of the community here have made this a priority, and then get deeper into what's in the climate action plan update that was just approved by the Board of Trustees. So to make light of a very serious issue, this cartoon basically shows that the United Nations and the international community has been essentially saying the same thing since the 1990s and will probably continue to say the same thing for the next foreseeable future, which is climate change is a significant issue, it's a global issue, some people would call it a transformative or a civilizational issue, but the science behind it often falls on deaf ears. There's often economic situations that are working against taking dramatic action. There's often political situations that make it challenging to take swift action. But the science community has increasingly been moving in this direction. I think that's why it's clear that the university of an institution has made commitment in this direction to take action on our carbon footprint. Now, this is a graph that many people saw, kind of Al Gore made it famous. I'm going to use it mainly just to point out a few things. So these are global carbon emissions here, parts per million in the atmosphere. And things were staying under 300 parts per million for quite a long time. And just last year, this was 2008, and then just this year we went over 400 parts per million globally for the first time since is known, when we get this way, the Pliocene epoch. And so back in the Pliocene epoch, 3 million years ago or so, you had alligators, swimming in all parts of the world. Now, so you had much higher sea level. So essentially, that's to say that carbon emissions have never been this high globally, and the actual amount of CO2 in the atmosphere has never been as high as it is currently. And what's expected now is that there's some different scenarios that we can predict or at least approximate. So if we are able, as a civilization, international community, able to stabilize our carbon emissions, then we may be able to keep parts per million between 500 and 600. But if we are not able to alter some of our economic and social behavior around the use of fossil fuels and greenhouse gas emissions, we're likely to see scenarios that bring things up to 900 parts per million. So what does that mean? Well, to put it bluntly, there's a nice reality and a not so nice reality. The two different scenarios that I just showed are kind of shown here in the rise, the change in global temperatures. So the lower emission scenario looks like here, where you might see a rise in 1 to 2 degrees centigrade global averages of rising temperatures. That upper emission scenario that I just showed looks much more dramatic, and a lot of the changes in global temperature are in the higher 7 to 9 degrees. So what does that mean for our nation? In particular, this chart shows essentially what some of our large metropolitan areas would see in terms of coastal flooding. So the 7% number is how much of New York City would be covered in water if we actually saw 1 meter of sea level rise, which is associated with about 2 degrees centigrade rise in global temperature. So that lower emissions threshold, or that lower emissions target that I just showed, if we are able to stabilize at that, we can anticipate that 7% of what's currently called New York City would be under some amount of water. If we don't stabilize our carbon emissions and we go to that upper limit, then we can see about 34% of New York City, what we call currently New York City, would be underwater. So when people are presented with this information at a scientific organization like Cornell and most of the other major research universities and research organizations globally, action usually becomes clear and obvious and imperative. So Cornell is essentially in sync with that global imperative by making a commitment to carbon neutrality, which is one way that we can improve some of the technologies and the adjustments that need to be made to mitigate carbon emissions, and also to begin to adapt to some of the changes in climate we're already seeing. So one last slide on the background of this that I'll show is that in the last report from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, essentially the world was given an approximate carbon budget. So what we know now is, generally speaking, how much CO2 is locked up in fossil fuels that we have access to but have not yet burned. And so so this up here is the total amount of CO2 associated with the declared reserve of all of the fossil fuel companies combined globally. And if we want to maintain under that 2 degrees centigrade of global mean temperature rise, which is associated with that lower level of sea level rise, then essentially we can only burn a portion of those proven reserves of fossil fuels. This is a new way that's being used to think about the challenge politically, economically, socially, to our situation around climate change, which is that we have access to resources that scientists are generally saying is not safe to consume. So what do you do in that scenario? Well, there's only a limited amount of things that universities can do. So I'm going to just talk briefly about what the university is committed to and where we're at on that set of commitments. So as I mentioned, we've committed to this national initiative for universities to become net zero emissions of carbon from our campus operations. We also, when we made that commitment, committed to integrating climate change issues into our curriculum and expanding research in related fields. So this was back in 2007, we first made this commitment. And since that point, we've seen dramatic progress. The university has a lot to be proud of. We've seen about a 32% reduction in our carbon emissions. This is associated with two major initiatives which took substantial financial investments from the university. Over $80 million investment in shifting from a coal-based power production system to a natural gas-based power production system, our central energy plant, and through nearly a $50 million investment in energy conservation. So we've been able to stabilize through energy conservation our actual energy use associated with buildings, even though campus has grown substantially. And so we've, through those investments, we've seen this reduction. production. What's left is about 218,000 metric tons of CO2 that we emit annually, and that CO2 is coming from on-site combustion, which is the natural gas we're burning to heat, cool, and electrify our buildings. We buy a little bit of energy from the New York State grid, which is technically one of the greenest grids in the country. We have the most amount of renewable energy in the actual electricity grid in New York State, so that's actually very low profile carbon emissions compared to other states. And there's the emissions associated with university-sponsored travel and commuting to and from campus by students and staff and faculty, and business travel off campus for Cornell purposes. So I mentioned our notable accomplishment of 32%. We've also made progress in the other areas where we made the commitment. The amount of sustainability-related courses, in particular the new climate change minor, and the amount of courses associated with climate change has increased substantially since then. And we've been doing a lot to engage people. There's now 79 buildings on campus, including this building, that have real-time energy dashboards. You can go and see real-time energy use, the carbon emissions associated with your energy use, and that number hopefully will get up to 150 in the next 2 years, so we can essentially see the real-time energy use of all of our major campus buildings. We've also had a significant amount of oversight and organizational development since 2007-2008. The President's Sustainable Campus Committee was set up by Scorton and is co-chaired by Tim Fahey from Natural Resources and Vice President Hugh Wong. Essentially helped provide kind of a leadership group for sustainability in a variety of areas, in particular to make sure that we're making progress on our climate action plan. So what lies ahead? Very important, I think these are some of the most important slides to talk about, because the achievements we've made to date were made essentially with low-hanging fruit, things that maybe sound like large capital investments, but actually have a very good bottom-line return on investment when you look at our combined heat and power plant or you look at energy conservation. The work ahead to actually get to carbon neutrality or climate neutrality is much more risky, much more ambitious. It's going to require a lot of activity on the academic side of the university in terms of prioritization of research areas so we can become a national leader in things like geothermal, bioenergy, wind energy, solar technology, and other technologies around carbon sequestration. Otherwise, this initiative is going to feel totally out of touch with what we are as an academic Ivy League land-grant institution. So a few of the key things that have been identified as our way, a pathway, or strategic direction to get to neutrality are listed here. So to give you a sense of the scale of reductions that you'll need to get from these technologies, here's currently our 2012 actual GHG greenhouse gas emissions. This is the 218,000 annual emissions that I just put out before. So here are just the top seven of the largest kind of approaches or technologies that we have identified that we think can help us get to a significant chunk of that carbon profile. So what these are increased energy conservation, which would mean increasing the payback period that we would allow ourselves to see a return on investment from energy conservation. It's currently around 7 years. We would have to potentially expand that to close to 15 years. That's taking on essentially more financial risk to see a return on your investment around energy conservation. There's building energy standards. We would have to build buildings at a higher energy performance level, which essentially means higher upfront costs for buildings and cheaper buildings to run as they reduce the maintenance and the energy costs associated with running them. But that has some financial implications. Optimizing the energy infrastructure we have currently, this is that white piece right there, just bringing our steam infrastructure up to kind of making sure that it's optimized, bringing it up and fixing a lot of the leaks. There's a lot of maintenance that has to happen every year, $7 million. So that in itself is its own financial hurdle. Producing renewable bioenergy on campus, partnership with researchers and farmers and landowners in the region. And probably the biggest piece and the biggest risk associated with the climate action plan that it currently is written is, and the biggest opportunity at the same time, is to develop a state-of-the-art energy enhanced geothermal system, which would be the first in this part of the country, which could power and heat, mostly heat, the majority of our campus. Now, this is a long-term project, it's a major infrastructure project, and it hasn't been done in this part of the world. We have some of the best researchers in the country on this topic. We have the attention of federal agencies and state agencies, but we need to make progress on this to even really fully understand the technical and economic feasibility of that, which in itself, just to demonstrate the feasibility, will take several million dollars in several years, which we know is a major hurdle. So, just to give you a sense of the scope of making a carbon neutrality commitment, I hope you're getting a sense of what we're up for. Wind power is a key piece of our region's energy resources, and we know there's development happening at Enfield, it's called the Black Oak Wind Farm, which is a project which is being seriously considered by the university as a way to support our more diversified energy portfolio. But there'll need to be more to get up to this level of greenhouse gas reduction. And whatever we can't reduce through switching to renewable fuels, we'll need to offset. And there's a variety of ways to offset carbon. You can do it by supporting efforts in your region. You can do it in ways to support efforts in the areas where we do research. So there's ways of doing this that are associated or linked to our mission as an academic institution. So, a few of the things that I'm going to say kind of to wrap up is to get an infrastructure that would look something like this, where you have solar panels, engineered geothermal, wind power, bioenergy, to combine that with the current technologies we have, like source cooling systems, the energy infrastructure we have with our combined heat power project, is going to require a pretty significant shift in business as usual. Most of the progress has been made on, as I said, kind of the lower hanging fruit, the easy return on investment type projects that were able to be led by facility services. And what we've identified and made clear to senior administration and the Board of Trustees heard when they approved the Board of Trustees approved the most recent update of our climate action plan is that those mechanisms to achieve those early successes are not necessarily how we can achieve carbon neutrality in the future, particularly given low energy costs and lack of a carbon emissions fee at the federal level or the state level. And so it's going to increase the need for us to really prioritize these things as academic priorities, as outreach priorities, so that the entire university is pulling in the same direction. This is seen as integral to what it is to be an Ivy League land-grant institution. Otherwise, this simply is not attainable. So, some of the key areas where there's action will need to occur, and I think this is underway with what President Gordon has tagged. In the next 2 months, faculty and staff working group to come up with a set of recommendations to actually accelerate to 2035, because our current goal is 2050, we're going to need to see increased emphasis in specific areas of applied research, which the President mentioned in his response to the Faculty Senate. We're going to have to see increased engagement and learning activities and staff engagement through HR and through our different staff units. Prioritize energy conservation and facilities in the way that I described earlier by extending payback periods. And the deans in particular, now with the new budget model, where they are responsible and both benefit from energy savings, they're going to be having to make decisions about investments in energy conservation that they haven't made in the past. And a particular point is that we're going to need to fundraise to be able to make progress in some of these areas. In the past, we have used essentially debt and essentially mechanisms that facility services has at its disposal, but the university has other means of bringing in capital that we have not yet tapped for this initiative. So the administration can reduce campus policy barriers in a variety of areas that are identified in the CAPS. We can initiate technical feasibility studies, sort of pilot scale type of activities, and we can provide access to capital. The senior administration has a role to play in this. It's not just at the college level and at the divisional level and kind of in all of our individual actions. There's going to be a role to play for kind of all sides of the university to make this happen. So with that, I probably have used up my time, but I'm not paying too close attention.
You're at time now. Are there questions for Mr. Roth? Professor Wayne.
I just made some cobalt steel that's working on some carbonate fossils. And so I was told that the lycopods and the calamites that grew so tall at that time grew so tall probably because the CO2 level was so high. So do you know anything about the CO2 level before 800,000 years ago?
Do I know about before 800,000? No. I'm sorry. Yeah, no. If I was a climate scientist, I might, but I unfortunately. So, can you help me understand what would that help us?
Oh, so I wonder. Actually, I'm totally agreement with your conclusion.
Okay.
But I really have questions about the climate.
Okay, that's what I'm asking. Sure. So just from a climate science point of view, how accurate is our data between kind of 800,000 after
before 800,000 years ago, and if there were similar rises as there are now,
yes.
What were the causes of those things?
So from the data that I've seen in the IPCC report, and most of that data is coming from doing ice cores in the various kind of cold caps. They do have some data after that, before that, and the general implication is that it hasn't gone above 300,000, even earlier, up to 3 million years ago. Now, I can't, unfortunately, talk about the accuracy and the reliability of that data beyond what's in the IPCC.
Mr. Bunk?
I just had a quick question. So in your CO2 emissions graph, you have travel and jet travel there. So how, like, I guess long-term, a lot of people will continue to fly past 2035. So do we get to zero by offsets, or how do you imagine addressing that stuff?
I think your assumption is essentially correct. There are activities in the university that will not be able to be mitigated through switching to renewable fuels. Essentially, what you can do, you can reduce demand, increase supply of renewable energy, and then anything that you can't make up in that scenario, you have to offset. So we have a certain kind of assumption that a certain amount of business travel, commuting, will be unavoidable, even if every single person on campus rode a bus or took a hyper-efficient fuel vehicle. In 2035, there will be some carbon emissions associated with that, and there will be some carbon emissions associated with air travel. And so we can begin to identify ways of either using our Cornell and Millennium to sequester carbon, which you can begin to do by doing active forest management, and we have faculty that are interested in doing that. There's then offsetting travel by supporting activities outside of kind of our direct sphere. There's a carbon offsetting program in the Finger Lakes called the Finger Lakes Climate Fund. We could be involved with that, which supports energy efficiency programs for low-income households in the Thompson County.
Thank you. That's all we have time at the moment for your presentation, but there may be questions later. Next, we turn to why Cornell's investment in companies producing fossil fuels should be reduced consistent with Cornell's progress towards carbon neutrality. And here we have Mr. Bergfalk is going to give us some insight. You have 15 minutes. I'm sorry, you have 10 minutes. Forgive me.
I don't remember when I first heard the term climate change or global warming.
can remember, though, when they first clicked me in an abrupt and terrifying way. I still don't know anything like it. The way in this issue, ethical questions, questions about how we take care of our world, shade into questions of survival. And the way those questions and timelines touch any of us who wants kids, or has kids, or cares for anyone else. There's a desperation, a numbness you work through to the certainty you are going to fight this. And we are fighting this in the best way we know now. I want to explain why divestment is, why these resolutions are so essential to that fight. Why? Number one, because it works. If you want, if you need legislation, as we do, a divestment campaign is one of the fastest, one of the surest ways to get it. In almost every divestment campaign we reviewed, from adult services to Darfur, from tobacco to South Africa, divestment campaigns were successful in lobbying for restrictive legislation. That's from a University of Oxford study in 2013. Before I go any further, I want to be clear what we're talking about. Divestment means getting rid of ethically problematic investments. For us, it means getting rid of our investments in those companies with the biggest coal and oil reserves. Those companies mean, those companies endeavor to sell those reserves as fuel. Now here you got a hand up. Remember, burning even a fraction of those reserves will be ruinous. And the choice among scenarios between those labeled safe, and those labeled tipping point, and those labeled nightmare, comes down largely to the question of those reserves. This is a question we're deciding in the very near future. This is a question we're deciding in a lot of ways right now. A divestment can feel, in all of this, small. Anyone who's worked long or late on this, believe me, wonders sometimes if it isn't. But when I do, I look at history and how local actions and resolutions here touch big history in the anti-apartheid movement of the 1980s. By 1985, that movement was decades old. But with the campus divestment campaigns of that year, it caught fire. Former President F.W. de Klerk, Nelson Mandela, Archbishop Desmond Tutu all attest the divestment movement, the campus divestment movement in particular, was instrumental in ending apartheid. Here at Cornell, demonstrations and sit-ins exploded in the spring of 1985. In fact, as we voted, 323-273 in favor of total divestment from companies operating in apartheid South Africa. The administration declined to divest. In the course of the year, over 1,000 faculty, students, and staff would be arrested. And Cornell's shantytown tactic, the construction on campus of characteristic South African dwellings, would spread across the country. In the following 2 years, 75 colleges and universities would agree to divest. So strong was the movement by October 1986 that Congress, with Republican-led Senate, would pass the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act over President Reagan's veto. And that legislation is widely regarded as the death knell of apartheid. Big players, Coca-Cola, General Motors, etc., began immediately to head for the exits from South Africa. And then there's a happy ending. In that 1 year since the 1985 faculty resolution, public opinion and the corporate environment had changed so much that Cornell's trustees would agree it was time to divest. I think there are a lot of lessons here. First, anyone who says divestment won't do anything hasn't done their homework. We're not trying to hit companies' bottom line. Divestment won't do that, at least not directly. We're trying only and strictly to face what's happening, to reckon with it, as a country, as a planet, but also as people, as a room, just like this, talking about what we're going to do. I've seen people talking about climate change this past year in a way I never had before, and that's so refreshing, it's so necessary, and I know that more than anything, it's a call for divestment that's gotten us. What I'm saying is I know nothing like that call for converting apathy, for converting indifference into engagement. I know nothing like that call for building a movement, and that's what's so exciting. Right now, when we so desperately need a movement, we're seeing it. 2 months ago, the New York Times profiled a group of foundations working together to divest, including the Google Family Foundation. It noted that 22 cities, 2 counties, 20 religious organizations, 9 colleges and universities, and 6 other institutions had signed up to rid themselves of fossil fuel companies, frequently defined as the top 200 coal, oil, and gas producing companies. And those are the companies we are targeting as well. All these commitments are fairly recent. That's why Time magazine called it the fastest growing divestment initiative ever. The anti-apartheid campaign took years to build. We've gone from almost zero to more than 300 campus campaigns in about 1 year and a half. Cornell has been, again, at the forefront of this movement. Our student assembly voted early and decisively, 22 to 2, to divest from fossil fuels. And our faculty were the first of any school of our stature to pass such a resolution. Again, the vote 46 to 13 was overwhelming. And again, other schools will follow. The GPSA has voted 16 to 1 for this resolution, and the student assembly has voted to back it as well. And a similar resolution is now before the employee assembly. This is the first employee assembly, I suspect, to draft one. All of this is an enormous credit to our university, and it is leadership that I ask this assembly to share in, to uphold, and to affirm. I ask it all the more when Cornell's environmental leadership among the lead universities is increasingly contested. For while Cornell has, as a result of these resolutions, accelerated its carbon neutrality target date to 2035, the roughly 250,000 student University of California system targets 2025, Duke targets 2024. And Harvard's recent announcement, its appointment both of a vice president in charge of sustainable investments and its endorsement yesterday of both the Carbon Disclosure Project and the UN's Principles for Responsible Investment, this is, to be clear, a step in the direction of divestment, are now setting the pace well out ahead of Cornell for environmentally responsible investment. I want to close with two other last lessons of the South African campaign. And I would emphasize that there is no objection to divestment, whether financial or tactical, that we're hearing now that we didn't hear then. First, we don't need the administration to sign off on our call for divestment for that call to do good. It's quite clear, too, that if the administration is at all anxious about the risks of divestment, which Professor Shalloway will show are in fact minimal, it won't sign off on it. So that a call for divestment can in fact only do good. This brings me to point two. Just as the anti-apartheid campaign did, this movement may change the value of the investments we're discussing. That is, the 1986 legislation, an effect of the movement, radically raised the cost of doing business in South Africa. Investments in South Africa very abruptly lost their appeal, and the campus moral demands of the previous year suddenly made perfect financial sense. A similar logic has led Forbes, The Economist, The New York Times, HSBC, all to write of a possible carbon bubble. When the world wakes to the fact that most fossil fuel reserves have to stay in the ground, which is precisely what we are after, these companies will fall in value. And it would be smart to get out before they do. So I've spoken long. I'll summarize in one last slide. There are four main arguments for that. Number one, it works. It is as effective a tool as I know in the fight against climate change. Number two, it's financially prudent. Fossil fuel companies face increasing legislative uncertainty and the growing recognition that their assets are largely on the brink. Number three, divestment is how Cornell can continue to lead. Divestment is how we make history. And we need to be thinking and acting that big, that decisively in the face of this crisis. And number four, it's the right thing to do. I think most of us understand our carbon neutrality goals. It's going to take money and time and ingenuity to achieve them. But how neutral will we be after all that, if we're still invested in, still banking on, betting on, hence rooting for, as Professor Shalloway will explain, ending that is, dollar for dollar, one of the most powerful, one of the most effective things that we can do. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Questions for Mr. Bergfall?
Yes. I just had two clarifying questions. One, I guess I'm not very familiar with the South Africa stuff. I guess, What effect do you think having like a civil war in South Africa had on doing business in South Africa? I guess it seems like there's a lot more going on than just like divestment going in and changing things. And then the second question I had is, in terms of globalizing renewable energy technologies, if these fossil fuel companies who have the capital to do that aren't going to do that, what companies do you think have that level of capital and global connections to make renewable energies a reality in our everyday lives? I'm just curious what effect do you think there being a civil war in South Africa had on doing business there in addition to divestment? I just don't think, like, during apartheid, there's other historical factors. Say what?
I think Civil War is maybe a strong term for it. Yeah, that's right. I mean, violence, yeah, certainly. I'll put it this way. Our own professor, Elizabeth Sanders, has spoken of a scholarly consensus that divestment was instrumental in any And that's again what Nelson Mandela said. That's what our sister
said. Okay, like I said, I didn't know.
Yeah, I'm sorry, your second question?
Yeah.
Could you
sure, I guess what avenue, if BP, Exxon, these companies that sort of have global energy distribution aren't going to globalize renewable energy, I guess what companies do you see actually doing that in the future?
That's the question I don't know how to answer. I think there probably some people should answer that. That's not my primary remarks. But also I think there was an email that went out that said some of these questions about the role of those companies in advancing renewable technologies and things that change it.
Professor Wayne?
They travel around the country and live with some coal mines in West Virginia. And not off a job, and I wouldn't want it, but there's a culture, a diverse culture that exists and is real. And it's the right thing to do to look after those people. So what are you doing to look after those people?
I view this revolution as the way we look after our children, our grandchildren. I mean, now of course, it's going to require economic investment, but I view these different No, I think we need green jobs. We need jobs that don't divide those people's livelihoods from the future of their children, that don't involve that kind of.
So I just want to ask, where in the priority of everybody's attention are those individuals? I'm just
bringing it. I mean, it's there. But if you're asking where is the valuation of these things, I would argue it's very high. If you're asking where is the valuation of coal jobs, I would argue that no, it's not.
It's a conundrum. Other questions for Mr. Bergfalk? If not, Professor Shallery, are you ready to set up for us, sir? Professor Shalloway will give an assessment of the financial consequences of divestment. His premise is that the consequences are, if I understand correctly, relatively minor to Cornell.
President Gorton's primary objection to divestment was the potential financial risk involved. We believe this risk is minimal and that the risk of remaining invested in the fossil fuel companies may be much greater. We, like everyone in this room, want Cornell to prosper while fulfilling its mission to enhance lives and livelihoods here and around the world. So I want to explain why we believe that we can get the benefit of divestment, its ability to draw attention to scientific reality and foster public demand for our climate action without financially harming the university. The Senate Finance Policy Committee met with Mr. Edwards, our chief investment officer, before the resolution vote in the faculty senate. This is what he told the senate before it vote. I intend to show you that this statement is not true, that the potential impact on the university is insignificant. The resolution is designed for Cornell to take a leadership role in climate action, both middle financial risk. It specifically targets the 100 coal and 100 oil and gas companies that will lose the most profits that fossil fuel revenue can do. Companies like ExxonMobil, BP, Peabody Energy, which you see the list. There's no constraint on reinvestment. The most profitable alternatives to domestic companies can be used. It saves in over 21 years a sort of dollar cost averaging that will help to smooth out relative equity value fluctuations. We'll see in a minute that this can be quite important. So we can reinvest in companies that redirect some of the $647 billion they're spending annually to expand fossil fuel reserves to instead invest in renewable energy. We've not been told what fraction of the endowment is invested in the public companies on the list, but we do know that 3% of our long-term investment pool, more or less the endowment, is in publicly traded energy equity, This fraction may also contain large energy utility companies like Halliburton and Schlumberger that don't own fossil fuel reserves and thus are not scheduled for investment. Therefore, 3% is the most it might be divested by 2035, but I'll use that upper bound in the calculations to follow. Investment will be phased in gradually, so the amount divested will be less than 1% until 2022 at the earliest. By this time, there may be strong financial reasons to get out of fossil fuel equity. To get an idea of the risk of investment, we can do what's called a back test, which analyzes what the results of investment would have been in the past. Our phase-in schedule will take 21 years, but a 23-year back test is important. It compares the cumulative growth of endowment that was completely invested in the broad stock market, RED, with a similar endowment from which the complete energy sector, about 10% of the market, was removed. The model overestimates the effects of divestment, such that assuming full divestment right from the start, it divests companies like Halliburton that we won't divest, and assumes 100% investment in equities, while we only have 56%. But it shows when divestment would have hurt and when it would have helped. For the first 10 years, you did better to be divested. Blue beats red. But for the next 8 years, you did worse, as the undivested portfolio caught up to and passed the divested one. This was the period of windfall profits for the oil companies, resulting from tensions in the Middle East and the Iraq War. Then from around 2008 to 2013, the divested portfolio again did better, caught back up. Over the entire period, you end up with essentially no difference.
Can you tell us what the y-axis is?
The y-axis is in percent gains, so it starts at zero, and apparently that's 500 at this point. There have been a number of studies of this type using different market indices, and while they differ in detail, it basically indicates that there's no predictable difference between invested and undivested portfolios in the long term they average out. This doesn't mean that you won't see differences in the short term. Here's a different comparison between undivested in blue and divested green using a Morgan Stanley index with or without the complete state energy sector. This is not cumulative. Previously, it's cumulative. Here we're looking at annual returns for a portfolio that's completely in equity. Again, during the windfall profit season, the undivested portfolio did better. For the last 5 years, the divested portfolio did better. The differences were small. Now we can combine these numbers with the Cornell endowment investment weighting to get an idea of how divestment would have affected Cornell returns in the past. Now this is approximate since it assumes that the invested amount is constant at $5 billion, that the total fraction invested in investment targeted companies is 3%, and it assumes uniform energy sector exposure. It doesn't account for the specific company weightings of our investments, but it gives a rough idea. This estimates that if we had completely invested 10 years ago, all at once, we would have lost about $10 million per year. However, if we had phased in investments as called for by the resolution, we would have essentially broken even. On the other hand, if we had completely invested 5 years ago, we would have made, by divesting, about $8 million per year. And if we had phased in investments starting 5 years ago, we would have gained about $6 million per year. This is because the fossil fuel companies haven't been doing that well relative to the rest of the market since 2008. So it's hard to make short-term predictions. But we don't have to. Investment's going to be phased in over 21 years, which gives us time for variations to be smoothed out, as suggested by the long-term data I showed you before. Whatever the annual variations are, whether negative or positive, they're in millions, which is tiny compared to the annual variations that we have had and can expect to continue to have with or without divestment. These variations are measured in billions. Last fiscal year, we made about $500 million. In the disastrous 2009 fiscal year, we lost about $1.3 billion. Another argument that's been raised against divestment is that it will prevent us from getting the best financial money managers in 5 years. they will object to having any restrictions placed on them, even in the early years, when the divestment schedule would probably be equivalent to sell Exxon or sell BP. I hope that our $5.7 billion endowment would give us some leverage in getting the service that we asked for. But even if that's not true, it's not obvious that we stand to lose that much. The external advisors have given us okay returns, but they haven't been exceptional when compared with our peers for the past 3 years. They may be important for our private partnerships, which do really great, but the partnerships aren't affected by the investment. The resolution does not restrict reinvestment of invested funds and does not insist on reinvestment in alternative energy. But this is something that should be considered. Last year was a bang-up year for the market, with the S&P gaining almost 30%. But broad indices that look specifically at clean energy companies like solar and wind are almost twice as well, getting about 50%. In contrast, the oil, gas, and consumable sector, which is a pretty good approximation to the companies to be invested, only gained about 15%. The analysis so far has assumed that the fossil fuel business as usual continues into the future, that the future will look like the past. But over half the book value of these companies is based on their proven fossil fuel reserves. And business, as in these Forbes articles, is starting to become aware of accepted scientific predictions. Burning all of the reserves will lead to a 4 to 8 degree Fahrenheit average global warming at a climate not seen since when the dinosaurs roamed Antarctica. Now this number I've quoted in Fahrenheit, which is smaller than the number that Dan quoted, which is in centigrade, this is taking into account some of the remedial measures that could come along. Those with enough money may be able to survive this, but the world cannot. Something will have to change. Fossil fuel CEOs maintain that we can adapt to this temperature rise or reverse it. Focused on profits, they aren't going to do much about it unless forced to by government action. I like engineering, but I think it's smart to apply it now towards developing renewables rather than waiting until later after the short-term profits have been made. The idea that we will pump all this carbon into the atmosphere, leaving it to our children to figure out how to pump it back out, doesn't make any sense to me. This is really an intergenerational conflict. I'm on my daughter's side. And the students have spoken, I'm on their side. My mom agrees with me. Mr. Edwards believes that the reserves will be burned regardless of the consequences, that there will not be enough demand by the public to use carbon taxes or other means to accelerate the replacement of fossil fuels with renewable energy. If he's right, we'll have much bigger problems than the possibility of losing some return on our investment. But other investors are starting to take the issue into account, starting to be concerned about the carbon bubble and what will happen when the predicted increase in adverse climatic events prompts the public demand for meaningful actions like carbon taxes. It's not just tree-hugging environmentalists. Norway's $920 billion trust fund, which they made from selling oil, is starting to consider whether it should continue to invest in fossil fuels or if it should start moving it to safe investments. Yep, showed you this slide. Some funds have already acted. Their $1.8 billion isn't as big as Cornell's $5.7, but it's significant. And in February, an internal audit committee of the British House of Commons concluded that fossil fuel companies are overvalued because investors have not yet accounted for the reality of a carbon-constrained world. They warned the UK and Bank of England that it must not be complacent about the risk of carbon exposure in the world economy. And public awareness is growing, particularly with the recent release of Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. The New York Times published at least 15 articles on climate change in 5 days last week. Even politicians have started to take notice, with the Secretary of State saying that the costs of inaction are catastrophic. But we've heard politicians talk before that it's going to take a grassroots movement to get the government action that it needed to accelerate investment in renewables to the needed levels. Nothing's going to happen quickly, but neither will I divest it. The climate will get worse before we have actually divested any significant amount. The increase in extreme weather events and well-publicized actions like divestment may wake people up. The percentage of Americans who understand that climate change is real may grow from its current 42% to a majority, and the financial outlook of the fossil fuel companies that don't significantly move to renewables may deteriorate. But even though we won't divest really very much for a while, the symbolic benefits of our action will occur immediately. There's no time to waste. There's a lag measured in decades between pumping carbon into the atmosphere and the resulting global warming. And even when economic actions have been taken that include the environmental cost of carbon, it'll take decades to build the needed infrastructure. Cornell is committed to pushing the envelope to showing the world that it can be done, and it's still going to take us 20 years and extreme effort. We need to promote social action now, but our example that it can be done will help to lead to broader action. We can be proud of our innovation, commitment, and action, but to be a leader requires that we step out in a visible way that will catch public attention. Unfortunately, the fact that we're one-third of the way to carbon neutrality hasn't been noticed. The fact that the entire University of California system is committed to carbon neutrality 10 years ahead of us by 2025 hasn't been noticed. The fact that the National Academy of Sciences, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change have been publicizing the scientific facts for years hasn't been noticed. And although the most recent IPCC report has gained a lot of attention, it's not enough. Yet divestment has a unique ability to draw attention and remain in the news. Americans notice when someone puts their money where their mouth is, and they notice when they don't. During the student assembly, before it passed the resolution, the student said, the Harvard president decided not to divest. They're Harvard. Shouldn't we follow their lead? Another student responded that Cornell should lead. Even though leadership always involves risk, we might make some money, we might lose some money. But among all the Ivies, we are the one having a land-grant mandate to take action for the public good. And even purely in terms of self-interest, this would be good for Cornell. We're probably spending millions on the glossy brochures and publicity that are aimed at raising our competitive stature. We've been establishing a reputation, branding ourselves, as the Ivy League leader in sustainability and climate action. Nothing will further this as much as divestment. Actually, even Harvard President Faust has changed their tune, and as of the statement released yesterday, is now moving Harvard towards a leadership position on climate change. They've hired a vice president for sustainable investing, and while not divesting yet, are formally signing on to principles for responsible investment that could shift their investments in the future. It's great to have an ally, but as a Cornelian, I still want us to lead. In the future, we'll look back and see if we were a leader in climate action or if we waited, hoping that others would say. One of the lead authors of the new IPCC report encapsulates this in a haiku. 40 years from now, children will live in a world shaped by our choices. The students and faculty have taken a stand. I hope you will join us.
Thank you, sir. Questions for Professor Shalloway?
I have a question. Perhaps not surprisingly. In sort of talking about this, what do you see as sort of the end game? Like, what is your dream scenario? We divest. What happens next?
Carbon tax. That's the end game. That's
say that again?
Neutral carbon tax.
Okay.
I guess the economists would differ about, you know, like that, like cap and trade. That's my dream scenario. Enough of a public movement to say we have to look in America. Things work, as I see it, by the market. And in response, partly to, I guess, it was your question before, Randy, market forces are the only thing that are big enough to make it happen. But it's not that much of a tilt that's needed. Actually, I can't say how much of this is due to subsidies, but we buy my house green energy, which you can do, you know, if you go on the web. I don't know, I think we pay $20 a year total, more than that. But it's not a big difference. But people will buy the cheapest. So something that's just enough
So your thought is like our representatives in Washington will see Cornell divesting and say, oh, we should now pass legislation to
do this. No. My dream is that Cornell will divest, other Ivies will divest, that will raise news, more articles in the New York Times, other places. Then 42% of Americans even believe in the scientific facts. Everyone seems to be asleep. I mean, the thing that's scary about this whole thing is it's not on the news all the time. It's getting there. But we need a social movement. That's my dream. They're not going to do it just from Cornell, but we can help these other universities and other universities can help these.
I've asked Mr. Bunk to set up for the next presentation. Well, Professor Wang, go ahead and ask your question, sir.
So I want to ask you about believing in the scientific facts. Whenever I ask anybody, what are the scientific facts that have eliminated long-term geological or astronomical effects on the planet? I get a blank answer. I'm going to ask you, where can I go for this information? Why can we dismiss whatever proportion of climate change is due to geological or astronomical effects?
A great resource, which is, you maybe you can Google it, or National Academy of Sciences put out a report in 2010. It's like 200 pages long or something. Well, it's getting a little bit old by now, but that's a great resource.
It is an old.
Yeah, well, anyway, I don't think that information's changed too much. I'll be happy to email you the reference. Or it actually, I believe, is referenced in the appendix of the resolution which you got by email. I'm pretty sure you'll find that reference in there. The IPCC report from 2013, the current one is more on how do we deal with it. It was the 2013.
I didn't print out the appendix.
And I believe that's referenced in the appendix. Again, I think if you just Google it, you'll find it. Those are probably the two best references that really give you scientific journal references.
Other questions for Professor Shalloway? Thank you, sir. I hope you and your team will stick around and for the end. And now we'd like to introduce the university's assessment of the potential consequences of divestment, which I think will be initiated by Mr. Edwards. Excellent. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. So just really quickly, I think this isn't anything new, but what we wanted to do was just recognize all of the different views that have been put forth, not only by the Senate, but by the students, the GTSA as well. I think everyone's familiar with this. And this is recognition. You know, we have a deep respect for this. This is very important. And we just wanted to make sure that everyone does recognize that it's something that we take very seriously. So let's talk about the role of the LPI. When we say LPI, that means the endowment, LPI's long-term investments. Energy today is about 9% of the LPI. One-third of that is in public stocks, two-thirds of that is in private investments. So the 3% figure that I just referenced earlier, that's correct. When we look at, now, I want to be clear that what I'm going to address is the impact of public stocks on the performance of the endowment. Over various time periods, because that's really the question at hand here, looking at these public stocks. So I just want to make sure everyone's clear about that. And I'll get to that a little bit later on. So if you look over the last 10 years, the public energy stocks have added about $100 million to the value of the LPI over that 10 years. Now, how do we get to that $100 million? We looked at the performance of the energy stocks, and a lot of them overlapped with the 200 that Professor Shalloway talked about earlier. There's In fact, today there's 185 aluminum stores there. And we looked at the actual cash flows, the actual weights within our portfolio. So effectively, instead of doing a back test, what we did was actually recreate our portfolio, assuming that these public energy stocks were not there. Now, back testing, I just will share with the group, is something that, from an investment standpoint, I have never and would never hire a manager based on back tests, because there's a lot of things that you actually take into a back test that you can basically get to the result you want to get to. So I'm just putting that out there. From an investment standpoint, we have never and will never hire a manager based on back tests. So what we tried to do, and I've reviewed the models with our CFO, our vice president, we basically tried to recreate our portfolio instead. Okay, what would have happened had we not had the energy stocks that we had in the portfolio the last 10 years? $100 million. You can call it $10 million a year, but roughly $100 million. One of the studies that has been put out there by a lot of advocates is the study by this group called the Aperio Group. Now, the Aperio Group, similar to some of the other studies that were shown in the earlier presentation, looked at the impact on indexes from excluding certain stocks. And then what happens when you exclude those certain number of stocks? Now, the Perry Group, they took 15 stocks out of a portfolio of 3,000 stocks, ran some tests, and some back testing, So we talked about this quite a bit. I discussed it with the group in many of our discussions that we had back in the fall, which I enjoyed tremendously. But I said, let's get someone else to take a look at this. So we asked Cornell professor Robert Jarrow, who's in the Johnson School, and said, here's the Aperio study. What do you think? Professor Jarrow actually looked at it. He actually published a paper, and this is his conclusion. The Aperio study is, quote, flawed from a theoretical and empirical perspective, unquote. You could certainly not defend a dissertation or even a master's thesis based on the way that study was done. So just to add some color around that, there's a big difference between the recreation that we did and back testing. $100 million, keep that number in mind. So you want to talk about the practicality of investing. So I think it's important for this group to understand that, like our peers, and by peers I mean Ivy clubs and other large foundations and endowments, we don't own securities directly. What we do is we partner with specialized managers across all the different asset classes, whether it be stock, private equity, fixed income, timber, et cetera, et cetera. We partner with specialized managers because there is simply no way to recreate all the talent that is necessary to invest across the world here in New York, in New York City, or anywhere, because it would really be cost prohibitive. So we partner with managers. That's fine. The other important part is that 55% of the LPI is overlooked. These are investments that are partnerships. We're locked in, legally bound to remain in those investments for a certain number of years. That's why we're talking about the public stocks. And that's an important distinction, but we can actually set that aside now because we're not talking about the private or the business. By placing restrictions on managers and telling them that they need to divest from energy or divest from other issues that have cropped up recently, placing those restrictions on managers would really have a significant impact on our ability to partner with the best managers. Now, I have some data that talks about what our actual performance is with our managers in the public stock portfolio and how they've done versus both generic benchmarks as well as the broad universe of managers. And I'll get to that in a minute. Now, keep in mind this idea of placing restrictions on managers. So we start with the asset allocation. How do we take the $6 billion that we have today and invest it? So the investment committee establishes the asset allocation based on recommendations by myself and the investment office. And effectively what we do is we compete with other investors to hire the best managers. So we all know the Ivy League has about $100 billion of assets just in the eight schools, including Cornell. And it quickly goes on from there. There was a mention of Norway, which is one of the largest, if not the largest, sovereign wealth funds. That has about $900 billion. If you look at all the sovereign wealth funds that are out there today, we're talking close to $7 trillion. That doesn't even take into account the large pension plan, the Canadian pension plan, the European pension there trillions of more dollars that are out there competing to get access to these best users. So the reason I'm talking about competing and trying to get access to best managers is, again, because we want to be able to hire a manager to do what he or she can do best and let them do it. And by placing restrictions on them, we actually could potentially hurt ourselves in getting in with those managers. Now, if you look at the public stocks only, if you look at the managers in that part of the portfolio, over the last 10 years, we have added about $164 million over what we would have experienced had we invested with median managers. So had we been stuck with just average or median, in this case, run-of-the-mill Joe manager, no best in one in Joe, we would have had $164 million less than we have today. Now, to put that in some kind of context, over the last 10 years, the draw on the endowment has been close to $2.3 billion. So what do I mean by draw? That's the part of the, okay, that's the part of the operating revenue of the university that's taken out of the endowment every year. So right now we're running about between $290 and $300 million a year to take it out of the endowment. And that goes towards university revenues. And we contribute about, round numbers, 10% of university revenues. So to put that $164 million, that's about 7% of that 10-year draw of $2.3 billion. Now, over the same 10 years, we outperformed indexes. So had we just gone passive, meaning just invested in a Morgan Stanley index, or we invested in Vanguard or Fidelity, what have you, there would be approximately, and again, keep in mind there are ranges around these numbers, just like any other model, no model is perfect, but this is based again on our recreation of our portfolio, not back testing. There would be about $260 million less today than there is. That equates to about 11% of that 10-year payout of $200 million. So that's an important distinction. Now, this is just looking backwards. We've also looked at this going forward. There were several quotes of mine. I'm always flattered when I see my name up in ranks on the board of quotations out there. Looking at the quotation in particular that I talked about, several $100 million and then multiple of that. We also took this analysis and extended it forward. So when we look at asset allocation, and I'll go through this really quickly, when we look at asset allocation in the investment committee, we've got models that we use. Start with basic textbook models, but then we expand it, make it a little bit more sophisticated because we hope that we're a little bit smarter. But we all know no model is perfect. In fact, every model is wrong. But looking ahead is where these similar impacts come in. So by excluding energy, not being able to invest with the best managers, not being able to, or having to invest with indexes of the managers, the magnitude of the impacts are similar. And in fact, going forward, our estimates are a little bit bigger. And that's what the quote multiple is going to be. So just want to work through that a little bit. Now, this is purely from a financial standpoint, looking at the numbers. Now, I said earlier there's only 185 companies, so let's look at the 200 companies. In total, it's about $4 trillion in market cap. So if you look at all the value of the outstanding stock of these companies, that trades on the New York Stock Exchange. It's about $4 trillion of value. As I mentioned earlier, the Ivy League has about $100 billion of assets. Now, Cornell has about 3% in public stocks. We talked about that. It's hard to tell what our peers have because you can look at annual reports and everything else, but there's not a tremendous amount of transparency into everyone else's holdings, even though I know every CIO and we talk all the time and we meet three times a year. You don't share that kind of information. So just for argument's sake, let's assume that they have the same 3% that we have. That's about $3 billion. That $3 billion equates to 0.08% of those 200 companies. The value of those is 0.08%. Now, if we only look at Cornell, it's 0.0048%. So from a purely financial standpoint, I'm not bringing anything else into this right now, just from looking at the numbers, if we were to sell all of our energy holdings today, we would be selling the equivalent of 0.0048%. And I can tell you, I've been in this business for a long time. you would not be able to pick up on the chart where Cornell is selling. It wouldn't even show up. Not even around here. So from this perspective, that estimate would be significant. So the next question is, okay, if we were to divest and we were to invest our money in alternative or renewable energies, which, by the way, I'll remind this group that we currently have about $71 million invested in renewable / sustainable type strategies. A year ago, we had about $60 million. So we've gone from 60 to 71. My staff and some of the students in the room, actually, I met with and shared the team a few weeks ago, and they had the pleasure of meeting one of my staff members that spends all of his time on the natural resources portfolio, which includes energy, which includes renewable energy, et cetera. And so they got to talk to him and hear what he does day to day. And we are scouring the universe, trying to find investments that we can make that meet the risk and return requirements established by the investment committee and the board of trustees, and still protect the value of our assets. Because at the end of the day, we're fiduciaries. We have to protect the value of the asset. That's our number one job. Secondary job is to generate a return for a given level of risk to be able to sustain the operations of the university. So, looking at the state of the renewable energy sector today, we've made investments, as I said, $70 million. For all intents and purposes, the returns over the last 8 to 9 years have been zero. And zero is actually a good return when you look at the broad universe. Most investments in this space have been largely negative. There have been many high-profile investment firms, both traditional investment firms and venture capital firms that back in the mid-2000s started up green funds, if you will. They made investments, they lost all their money, they shut down the funds, they fired the people, they didn't know. Okay? That's happened more than once, but that's just one specific example. Looking at public pensions, there have been talks about pensions that have gone into renewables, but they've also experienced the poor returns as well, and they've actually begun to reduce some of their renewable investments as well. If you look at a lot of the companies that are out there today, there's billions of dollars that have been given out in government loans and grants to companies, and there's a significant amount of these companies that are now bankrupt or they're distressed, even with almost free money or money with very low interest rates. They're not able to generate a return. Governments moving to voluntary support, you know, if you look at the plight of Germany and Spain in Europe, their electricity costs are going through the roof. It wasn't too long ago that there was a quiet announcement that targets for renewable energy have effectively moved from mandatory to voluntary. They actually need the details. Because the likes of Germany and Spain, particularly those two, their electricity costs are going through the roof. And at the end of the day, there was a reference earlier to people in the coal mines. You know, there are people that have to pay their electric bills. And not everyone is as blessed as most of us are in this room to be able to afford continued increases in their electricity prices. And governments respond to that. It's important. Corporates provide bulk of investment. There was a question earlier, if the energy companies, they're the ones that have the capital, if they don't invest the money, who's going to do it? Well, in fact, yes, they are spending $600 billion a year on exploration and production, but at the end of the day, that's something they need to do to be able to keep the fuel going, to keep the economy and the world running. At the same time, they've also committed over $20 billion. The top five energy companies, and you are probably all familiar with the top five energy companies, they have over $20 billion in commitments. Now, you could look at it and say, okay, there's wind farms, there's green technology groups, there's ethanol. We can argue and debate about ethanol, but this is something that they're doing. So they are the ones that are taking steps to find the next big thing. It's going to take a while. It's going to take a long time. But they're the ones that are doing it. And as was noted earlier, they have the capital. We can argue 20 versus 600. At the end of the day, I don't know anyone else that's put the 20 on. So I'm glad that they're doing it, and I hope that they continue to do it because we all want to change. It's just a matter of how to get there. Independence of the LPI is really important. How am I doing on time, Mr. Chair?
You're coming to the end of your 15 minutes.
Okay, I'll wrap it up. So one of the important things is independence of the LPI. In general, the way the investment committee and the board look to operate this as independent of political or special interests. We did divest from Sudan after President Sorum came in 2006 and signed. Basically, this was a university issue, but quite frankly, didn't have any investments in Sudan. Now we check every year, and we look into this, but that wasn't something that really impacted the government. I would note that we did not fully divest, and I think that was accurately described earlier on, but I think it's very important to note that we did not fully divest in South Africa. And in fact, in 1989, when the vote came up before the board actually voted to remain in the companies they were invested in South Africa. The board felt very strongly at the time, and President Rhodes actually made the quote, I found this, that our, and I'm paraphrasing here, but our act of divestment as a gesture is an so we did remain invested. We remained invested in the companies that adopted the Sullivan Principles. I was able to offer you to study the Sullivan Principles. But we were there, and we stayed there. Now, I don't want to take daily, but weekly, certainly, I get emails all the time saying, hey, we have this wonderful project here, we have this wonderful project there. You have $6 billion, how about we talk? We could use a little money. We've talked about student housing. We've talked about things in college now. I was asked to fund a facility at JFK for a school that I won't mention, but it was a substantial ask. And at the end of the day, it would have looked great. The headlines in the New York Times would have been fantastic. It would have been a horrible investment for Cornell to make. So I recommended we not do it. And that we actually did not do it. So we want to be really careful on how we manage the assets that we have. These assets, where do they come from? They come from some places. They come from donors, and they come from investment returns. Now, I treat a donor that gives a dollar, I treat that dollar, and I think about that dollar the same way I think about the donors that give $500, $600 million. Someone works every day to earn the money to be able to give it to Cornell, and that's the way I need to think about it, and that's the way the investment returns. We're also very aware of the precedent that we have set. So if we were to divest from this issue, I guarantee that there's a lot of other issues coming down the line because we're a huge population here. People have a lot of different views about a lot of different things. People are very passionate, and that's the great thing about Cornell. But you can't manage a $6 billion pool of assets that way. Peers, just really quickly, the publicly announced knows Cornell and five others. We have about $56 billion. Harvard, they hired a VP of Sustainability. They hired her last year, and she is basically doing what my staff member is doing, looking for investments. We'll see how successful they'll be. I surveyed 19 other institutions, and combined, those 19 other institutions have $100 billion. They've either not gone public with their nose, they either haven't gone public with their nose, or they haven't been asked to divest. In the cases where they haven't been, if they were asked to divest, their answer would be no. And then the yeses we talked about, the seven schools, you know, combined of $150 million portfolio, those are really schools. And then the foundations we talked about, I think if we look a little bit deeper in those foundations as well, you see the average size of 100, there's some decent variation there, but there's also mission-driven investment. So I would also point out to the World Bank president, if you read it carefully, you call for divestment, but they are not divesting out of their portfolio. The other thing I would add is one of my investment committee members is CIO of the IMF pension plan, and while they have not been asked to divest, if they're asked, the IMF would not divest out of energy in their pension plan idea. Norway, they have $900 billion, but I would also add that they bring in $40 billion of cash a quarter. So we have $160 billion of cash that comes in from the energy fields, from the oil fields. And when you're approaching $1 trillion in an economy that's big, they have no other choice but to diversify into other asset classes. So there may be some interest in getting into other things outside of fossil fuels, but by necessity, they have to. And they have that much more than they. So I think I've said all this in the past or in other parts of the portfolio, other parts of the presentation. You know, we have a lot of things that are very important that are going on. 2035 is a great date, but they did it, moved from 2050 to 2035. We have the Atkinson Center. Let's raise money for the Atkinson Center. There's some fantastic research that's going on there. Foster research in new renewables. You know, the Department of Energy is a big donor in terms of research. There's a lot of things that can happen here that can help us get to the next step.
Vice President DiStefano?
I'll just stay right here since I don't have a presentation. I just want to take 2 minutes and give a perspective from my role as the Chief Financial Officer at the University. So I'm responsible for the overall financial health of Cornell. And our endowment returns are the driver of our financial success. If you look at our change in our balance sheet, which is what I pay attention to on an annual basis, everything else is insignificant, and what is significant and what impacts our financial ratios is the money that we earn off of our endowment. And the more we earn off of our endowment, even if it's not realized earnings yet, it helps our financial ratios. 4 years ago, Standard & Poor's credit rating agency downgraded Cornell, and we have not yet been able to come back up to where we were. So we're 3 notches down in credit rating from where we should be. I also think that there's an awful lot that we all in this room, every one of us, agree on. I don't think there's anybody that disagrees that we need to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases emitted into the atmosphere. Divesting, though, does not directly accelerate Cornell's progress towards carbon neutrality. And I think somewhere between Professor Shalloway's data and A.J. Edwards' data of what the impact is of divesting is the real number. I don't know what it is. $2 million at the low end, $260 million at the high end. We're somewhere in between there, and I don't think we can argue that it's going to be some cost, negligible or what, for, as AJ says, it impacts it impacts us significantly. I think everyone who presented today also admitted that divesting with the volume of fossil fuels that Cornell has in our public equities portion of our portfolio would be nothing more than symbolic gesture. I think we're safe to say those are all things that we agree with. Where we disagree are, I see two things. One is what the purpose of the endowment is, and should we and can we use the endowment to make political and social statements. The endowment started when Ezra Cornell started at Cornell. It's been growing to where it is today over 150 years. And it's been built to advance our academic mission at the university. And if everyone has a pet project that they want us to divest, and there's others that are coming down the pike right now to the university to consider for divestment, we won't have the longevity that we've had in the past. The other area where I think we disagree is what the real impact is on these divestments of the financial health of the university. The studies that Professor Shalloway has presented show a minimal impact. The types of schools and the types of investments are not the types of investments that Cornell does. Cornell, because we're multi-billion dollars, we're very complex. And our returns, as AJ mentioned, are predicated on being able to hire and having access to the best managers. And we don't just do indexes. I mean, that's not what we do, and that's not how $5 billion, almost $6 billion investment should be. So many of you have heard the President Scorton speak over the last couple of months, and he would even say, if the best-case scenario of a $2 million impact on Cornell's financial situation is too great. You've heard him say that he's projecting a $3.5 million operating balance at the end of this fiscal year. I'm the one who gave him the $3.5 million. We now have 8 months of actual data. Our projections are currently $959,000 is our balance at the end of June this year. So even a $2 million impact means that we either have to raise tuition or cut something out of the university just to be able to do $2 million. And what I really ask this group to do is focus on where, as a university, we can have the most impact. And if I think everyone agrees that achieving carbon neutrality by 2035 is our goal, It's not going to be easy. As Mr. Ross said, we've already gone after the low-hanging fruit, and he mentioned we spent $130 million to get that low-hanging fruit. That doesn't even include the $60 million that we spent from wastewater pooling. So we're talking we spent almost $200 million to get to that small, significant portion on the thing, on the tariffs. We should be focusing on putting our money into achieving the carbon neutrality. So all I ask is that for one thing to think about is, can't we decide to focus our attention in real ways that will make a difference rather than symbolic gestures?
Thank you, ma'am. Questions for AJ and Vice President Stefano? Bridget?
My first question is, are you saying that we do not place any restrictions on the managers? We don't have any say whatsoever in any investments that they
So the question is, do we place any restrictions on our managers?
In the type of companies that they invest in, the type of...
So we start with the premise that we are going to hire not only the best managers, but the most ethical, moral, etc. That's part of our due diligence process.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the background check process that we do. We do criminal background checks. So we start with the notion of price. We're going to hire the most ethical and we're going to hire. So we start with that. Where we do work with the managers is it depends on the asset class. I'm not going to get too much into the details. I'm going to try to keep it on a level of it. Depending on the asset class, from a risk control standpoint, there's going to be certain things that we'll say based on what the manager says they can do. We're going to say, okay, you're the best at picking banana producers. I'm just using that as a simple example. Okay? So, all right, you're the one that's going to pick the companies that produce bananas. We don't want to see you going out and investing in digital countries. So that's a simple example, but depending on how the manager manages the portfolio and the asset class that he or she is in, there's going to be some risk control that we'll put around it. But it's not from an exclusion standpoint for the most part. It's okay, this is what you do, this is what you evaluated, and you do a good job at it, and this is what we want you to do for us. And if we see you doing something else, that may cause us to question whether you have the skill set to do that.
So
I don't know if that answers your question or not.
So you're saying that in a way that we're already limiting what we feel they should be doing with the money by the way we pick them?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say we look at, and again, it's going to vary on the asset class, so it's difficult to answer generically what I'm trying to. When we're looking across what our asset allocation is, we have targets for each of the asset classes. So whether we want 25% in long or short stocks, then look for a certain number of managers to fit into that part of the portfolio. And we're going to look at the universe of managers that are out there, and we're going to look at how the managers add value over the various benchmarks of the time. And we'll focus in on the ones that are better than median managers and that fees are better than indexes or passive managers. And then we'll get into, okay, this is what you've historically done and how you've done it. That's great. That's what we want in our portfolio. But in general, what I would say is whether it's a large cap, so they're buying large companies, you know, GE, Microsoft, etc., or small cap, you know, a lot of smaller companies that you've never heard of, there's indexes for all of those different types of strategies. And what we don't do is really say, okay, you can't invest in this sector, or you can't invest in that sector. You leave them the latitude based on what they've done, if that makes sense.
If I can interrupt here, can I have a motion to extend the meeting 10 minutes so that we can continue this discussion?
No, we're just 15, so we don't have to do another 5.
Very good. 15 minutes from Mr. Measy. Do I have a second?
Second.
Any objections? Mr. Ruiz Calderon, question.
Mr. Edwards, you mentioned that this 3% created $100 million in 10 years. Can you give us a percentage as opposed to a number? Like, what percentage return was that actually? And can you compare that to actual portfolio percentage? And then if you want to go on a lot of percentages, can we go how many sectors outperformed and how many sectors underperformed? So, well, first off, just how, what was the return percentage on this 3% that we invested?
Right. So if you look over the last 10 years, the broad stock market, so I'm looking at the Russell 2000, which is also happens to be the same index that we pair with. Over the last 10 years, and this was through December 31, it was up all around 7.5%. Okay. So the energy index, or the energy sector, was up about 6 percentage points better than that. So 13.5%. That's where we got that 6 percentage point difference. Okay? And that was the, those were the numbers that we used as part of our analysis.
You said the portfolio outperformed, though, the actual Standard & Poor's 500. So what was the actual portfolio's return? That's, it wasn't a 7.5. It had to be higher.
Which portfolio?
You said our portfolio outperformed, or the investment portfolio outperformed the actual markets. If the market was 7.5%, what did we actually return? What was the entire portfolio percentage return on percentage?
For the LPI as a whole, or
yeah,
or the public market stocks?
No, the LPI as a whole.
Over the last 10 years, it was 8.9, just over 8.9.
And then do you know how many sectors? So that's
the 8.9 is for the entire
county were underperformed and overperformed, private and public.
Yeah.
Are there, I'm assuming we invest in many different sectors. So how many sectors?
We're in every sector.
Exactly. So how many sectors overperformed this 13.5%?
How many sectors overperformed?
Yeah.
Outperformed the 13.5%?
Ideally, what I would see, if you take out the 3%, you can just reinvest it into these that outperformed in the last 10 years. Or overperformed.
Yeah.
So that's why I wonder how many actually did.
I don't remember the exact numbers off the top of my head, so I'm not gonna say, you know, this did that or et cetera. But what I would say is, looking back in hindsight, it's very easy to say, well, you could have invested in this sector or that sector and done better.
Mm-hmm.
Playing Monday morning quarterback, that's back testing, and that's not something that we want to try to do, because
I'm not saying looking forward to the future. If we were going to digest.
Oh, well, looking forward in the future, when I talked about our asset allocation models, and where I said that when we looked at the impact of having energy in the portfolio on a forward-looking basis, so if you look at the forecast that we have for all of the different asset classes, in fact, energy is one of the highest expected returning asset classes that we have on a forward-looking basis. So over the next 7 to 10 years, based on our work, and this is work that's been verified and in fact certified by the investment committee, which is what goes into our forward-looking return assumptions, that Vice President Stefano and the Vice President for Budget and Planning use in their models for the university. So we're developing models for the best ability that we can. We're developing forward-looking return assumptions that get used in the official models that the CFO
Professor Shalloway, if I may ask a question, if the university divested, if they followed the faculty senate's resolution or something near to it, and we have this moral leadership position, who is going to take it up and actually project that leadership? So we'll get some newspaper coverage, no doubt, but what is the plan? Does anybody have a plan to actually be that leader or leadership group that then convinces other universities to divest, and we get this domino effect that perhaps you would hope for?
Yes. At the last faculty senate meeting in this was March, and President Horton was there, he was asked almost not about divestment, but he was asked the question, if we do our 2035 carbon neutrality, who's going to know? And what Brian Chabot, in response to that question, he gave the committee, the 2035 committee, Hugh Wong, and he gave them an additional task, which was just to address that question, to also look at ways at which what we do here can be seen. That's going to apply, he was saying that, of course, in regards to how's the world going to know that we've done this carbon neutrality thing, but he recognized the need for public studies. I assume the same mechanism would be used, or that would be a good mechanism to use to assess it.
I guess my point to members, not to be obscure, is I have several emails that come into my desk as part of these discussions, and so some of the a train of thought that hasn't been brought out today that I want to bring out is, if Cornell, you know, does lead on this subject, what does that leadership look like? If we're going to potentially risk some endowment negative returns or the cost of achieving carbon neutrality is going to be expensive the last third, and we're encumbered financially because we're also out of the sector that may be the one that's performing at the time we need it. Maybe not. Maybe it is. So there's this give and take balance. Do we have a plan? Is there a plan to actually exert that leadership for the desired outcome? Because if there's not, there are some that say, well, this, you're right, money talks, but Cornell's money really won't at this point. If there isn't a plan to actually build on it, then should we take the risk with funds that we live off of until that plan is in place and has shown some traction? And so it's just a set of thoughts that have reached me. Sir?
Let me just add, so Brian Chabot's on that committee, and he told me personally that he intends to, I don't know that this will happen, but it is his intention to sort of set up a subcommittee within that committee to address this question, which has an important kind of empowerment to deal with disability. Just anecdotally, I'm in touch with reporters in New York Times trying, you know, to drum up news. And I didn't touch them. And when I told him that, Frank, he was anxiously waiting to hear what the president's response to the faculty resolution would be. And I emailed him excitedly, well, at least we approved the 2035 acceleration. And his response to me was, tell me when you divest. Now, I don't know why divestment is such a big deal to the New York Times and the world's attention, but it is.
Professor Burns.
David, I have trouble with this argument that we can take the moral high ground by doing something which everyone says we're only doing symbolically. How do we take the moral high ground by saying, we know this isn't going to make any difference, and so we'll do it?
We are going to put an enormous effort into the 2035 carbon neutrality.
I have no quarrel with this 2035, but I'm asking this other question.
Go hand in hand. Why are we doing 2035? That basically is also a symbolic statement. And that's partly what it does is that there will be research, there will be capability demonstrated, particularly for the geothermal water section of the country. But mostly what we're doing is symbolic, because even though my light bulb is a drop in the bucket, all of Cornell's energy systems are also a drop in the bucket. And we are saying, to that extent, we are putting our money, our effort, or our masses. There's nothing that any individual or even any organization of the size of Cornell can do that isn't symbolic.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we're essentially out of time, unless we want to extend. I want to move on to the next piece, which is the follow-on action by the University Assembly. What I've just passed down the rows, and I can project it, but I'm not sure that you're going to want to go far into this since you haven't read it yet and really thought about it. What I have is a resolution. There's two resolutions, one on the front, one on the back. The one on the front is an outline of support for the Faculty Senate resolution as currently written. It basically recounts the Faculty Senate resolution, its two main tenets, that it was forwarded to us for support, And then it says, we declare support for achieving carbon neutrality by 2035, and further, we declare support for divestment, and that we want them to report annually on it. That's what resolution, call it X1, the front page, the first lines 1 through 42 say. If you flip it over, there's X2. X2 is the same whereases from the front. It just recounts the facts. It still supports carbon neutrality to 2035. I did not oppose that because informally the group seems to be in general consensus there, but that's not in evidence, so I don't want to get ahead of you. But the next sentence says, however, we're not for divestment. Okay? Because it would be symbolic and the negative effects are perhaps not right for us at this time. Okay? There's a third option, to not address divestment at all. We could write a completely different resolution. But fundamentally, the task we've been asked to do is to review the Faculty Senate resolution and join it, refute it, or be silent on it, is up to you. So I've drafted two versions. One's fully support. One's the support that I believe I know of, and I know that there are varying opinions on divestment, and since you've now heard different sides of the story, I'm not sure how your views might formulate, and most of you will probably need to think about them. You're not going to want to engage on this tonight. I will circulate this by email tomorrow and solicit your internal comments. My goal would be to get them from you between now and the April 22nd meeting so that I can formally introduce a resolution to you that has the general consensus of the members, and then we'll put it out for probably an abbreviated public comment, and this would probably be a sense of the resolution, a sense of the body resolution, because we don't have time to fully publicly vet what we might say. But also, your various constituent assemblies have already passed measures on it, and if I understand an email that Ulysses sent earlier, there's perhaps a new resolution on divestment that may come to the student assembly later this week.
Yeah, this is actually where I have to step out. I'll be very brief with this. I actually encouraged a lot of those members to actually attend this so they could get a better understanding of this entire process, in hopes that, I don't know, maybe some things might be quelled or just accurate information. I don't know, but there is another resolution. I think it's a bit more political than fossil fuels, but
okay. So if I just understood you, it was probably some of the other issues of, is the endowment, how is it going to be used for these kinds of purposes, which is a very fair question. It's also not a reason to shy away from doing what you think is right, but you should be aware of it. So one second, Bridget. I will circulate that electronically and select feedback. If there is general consensus by email, I'll put out something formal. If the views are all over the map on it, then we'll, at the April 15th meeting, gather the horses and decide whether we're going to try and form a subcommittee to gain through this before the end of the term or not. We're running out of space in this assembly. That's not the death knell of this. The whole world doesn't stop just because the assembly goes out of session. But we may be writing a point paper for our successors to pick up, depending on what you decide to do between now and the 15th, if we're all clear on that. Ms. Shaffer.
I did ask Joanne and AJ if they could share their presentation with our assembly. They said you had an electronic copy.
I have an electronic copy of Mr. Edwards' presentation, and with his permission, I would be glad to.
That's fine.
Very good. Professor Wayne? Sure, if you think it's relevant in the time we have.
I was impressed with the backup. And you told us, you showed us a quote that it was theoretically insecure, that approach to the security of the middle of the high school. You never told us why.
At a high level, back testing, you can create any result you want to create. So in reality, managing investment portfolios is very messy. There's a lot of considerations that have to be taken into account. And looking back, it's a very nice, simple, contained world when the only variables that you're looking at is an index, exclude this stock, exclude that stock. That's a very simple way, and smart people like Jeffrey and others can certainly manipulate their computers to come up with the result that they want to. I'm not saying he did that in this case, I'm just illustrating the point. Managers, I have looked at over my 20 plus years in this business, I have looked at countless back tests that show they have the secret sauce, quote unquote, to managing portfolios and generating the most alpha or outperformance over whatever the index is. When in fact, when they go live and actually have to buy and sell and manage liquidity and regulations and taxes and all the other things they don't manage in the portfolio, they fall flat on their face. So that's why we never hire a manager based on back tests. And to the gentleman's question that was being asked earlier, I apologize, I can't see your name, about the sectors that either outperformed or underperformed over the last 10 years. And if you exclude the energy, which is 13 and a half, you could have just invested in those other ones that did better. Sure, I can do that today. I can put together a fantastic portfolio that will give you a 10-year return of 25%. That's not reality. And at a high level, that's what backtesting is. You constrain your universe to this, and then you move things around in there to get the result that you're looking for. And I can't manage.
If I can summarize that, you're looking at a crystal ball, and we're one Malaysian aircraft, you know, going missing in a whole sector, its returns are going to be affected, and you can't see that in advance.
Liquidity issues, there's so many exogenous, yeah. There's so many exogenous effects on a portfolio, you can't do it.
Professor Burns.
It may be relevant. The Financial Policy Committee looked at this, and David spoke in front of it, and AJ spoke in front of it. And if I could summarize that, I think the economists on that committee, to a person, disagreed with the Aperio analysis and felt it was inadequate. They also were not real happy with the presentation they got from AJ. It felt that it was overly optimistic. So, you know, maybe it's faculty.
Pessimistic or optimistic?
Huh?
Overly pessimistic or?
No, overly optimistic.
That we would have lost more than $200 million.
No.
Okay, all right. All right. Professor Shalloway, you wanted to.
I just wanted to say, I can show you a chart from the period. There are about four different settings. They all reflect that Ontario is one of them. I did not show the Western Ontario when I showed it. Oh, I forget the name, but it's on the slide that you have on the handout. They all basically show the same thing. It's hard to predict. I would ask AJ, if you do, there are, like I said in my slide, my calculation also shows that we would have lost $10 million per year for $200 million over the last 10 years if we had invested this. And I showed you the other numbers. If you slide in, it averages things out. More recently to be better. The bottom line is I don't think it's predictable. So I'm not saying we won't lose. I'm not saying we won't win, but then you don't know. To predict it for choice, and I think the amount over a 21-year slide in things tend to average out. But I didn't talk about it very much.
Okay. Thank you, sir. And thank you all for, I know it's a very important issue and very charged, and I appreciate everybody's point of view today. Thank you. Are there any other topics for the agenda today?
Yeah.
Professor,
I don't know exactly which day it is, but it's at least very close to Jim's birthday.
It is today.
Oh.
Today is my birthday. The big 5-0. Thank you. And with that, I may ask unanimous consent to adjourn.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.